To use their facility again, it's become a habit. This is a new room though, and we're still trying to work out a few of the issues with the technology here, and hopefully we'll have that when we need it.
Well, hopefully in 2 more years, the building over to the, just north of us here, will be getting remodeled. The back half of it's going to be coming off because that's not original. There's original 1920s, 40s, and 70s. The 40s and 70s is crap. So we're taking it back down to the original 1920s. I still need to find out in the minutes why in 1920 they encapsulated the 1880s inside the 1920s. So there's a building inside a building. But on the second floor, we're going to put in where the old courthouse is and have a conference area in there and restore it back. So when you go into that building, when it gets all done, we'll have the original corbels up above, and the old courthouse will be, have more meeting space there, which will probably be more accommodating for us when that gets done in about 2 more years. So.
Well, if we get the technology worked out, this is great. We appreciate it, and I'm glad to hear what you're doing with the old courthouse. And we'll take advantage of that space as well. Thank you, Commissioner. We do have a quorum present. An agenda was provided to you in advance. We received no requests for additions or changes to that agenda, so I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda as presented.
Second.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Leland. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? It's unanimous. You also received the meeting notes of our last meeting, which was held on September 11, 2019. We didn't receive any corrections or changes to those, and so I'll entertain a motion to approve the meeting notes of the meeting of September 11.
So moved.
Thank you, Leland. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Dave. Any discussion or debate? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? That's unanimous. So we have three brief council or committee reports. We'll start with our membership report from our membership committee chair, Leland Myers.
Every position is kind of sort of full. We have one that's awaiting. We have the one from Salt Lake County is has been appointed as Carlton Christensen. He had an alternate that was attending. That person is retired also. So we have a nominee from the county that's in. We would hope that they would have been finished and completed in the process, but it's still sitting in the governor's office waiting on something. We're not sure what that something is. But it's from the county. It's an individual nomination of Dana Blaze. So we assume it will go forward just at their time. In the meantime, we're going to suggest that she just attend as the alternate for Carlton. And other than that, we got full membership until somebody has to leave or until we get a new this year there are several that are going off in theory. So we need to, I will be talking to those who are up for possibly leaving the council, and we need to go through some hoops. Particularly if you've had 2 terms, there's a bit more hoops we have to jump through to get through the 3rd. Any questions?
Great, thank you, Leland. We also want a brief update on the Salinity Advisory Committee from Jeff Denblaker, who's managing that committee.
Yeah, the Salinity Advisory Committee reconvened in November, this past November. The objective of the committee is to provide, have all the different experts working on the Great Salt Lake, develop recommendations for research, monitoring, and in the end, recommendations to the state for how they should manage the new breach in the causeway that Union Pacific installed back in 2017. We are going to be working towards developing a new monitoring research plan that's focused on salinity. The committee just completed a round robin just looking at how all the different organizations monitor and measure salinity in the Great Salt Lake. We've got a subcommittee meeting next week to talk about that, just to make sure everybody's on the same, using the same methods, both in the field and in the laboratory, to report salinity information, and then having the next committee meeting at the end of January. The goal is to be able to get to a draft research plan by the spring, and start working on a decision framework that the state can begin to use, evaluating the slang information as that comes in. So,
any questions? Good to see that committee up and running and moving forward. Thank you, Jeff. We have a couple of other projects we're working on. Let me mention, as you know, by statutory requirement, we have to do an annual report. This is last year's annual report. It's a four-page glossy that talks about what we've done during the year. The text for the new annual report is basically complete, and we'll send it to council members this week. If you have any comments or feedback or suggestions or corrections, would you please get back to us by sometime next week, if possible. Any questions about the annual report? We should have it out by the end of the month, I believe, and it'll be dated February of 2020. Yes?
Don, as my memory serves, there's been an opportunity where you or others have presented to the legislative committees. Is that a regular occurrence or something?
That is. I think we have good communication, as well as the since our last meeting, we had a meeting with Brian Steed, the director of Department of Natural Resources, and a meeting at DWQ. So we're trying to maintain fairly regular contact to brief them on what we've done. And then we had a meeting as well up at the state capitol with Phil Dean and Evan Curtis to brief them on the two studies that we did this year. And they were quite well received, actually. As you know, our principal focus as a group, since we weren't given a lot of money and a lot of authority, is to inform the debate. And I think those reports are accomplishing that purpose, and the others that we have underway. Any other questions about that?
Just on the report, this is our 10th report, so I think we'll suggest, would the chair consider icon of some sort to acknowledge the fact that this will be our 10th report on it.
You know, you raised that issue before and it just fell off my page. I apologize. I'm happy to do something to acknowledge the 10 years.
Maybe we'll have a resolution or something like that.
Okay, can we put you in charge of making that happen? Great. How do the rest of you feel about that? Good for some kind
of... Sounds great.
Run out to Rotunda and have a banquet? Is that what you think?
Big dinner.
Thank you, David.
As long as Dan is doing this, that's me.
That's great.
So we have two major presentations on our agenda today. As you know, the health of the Great Salt Lake ecosystem, particularly the brine shrimp population in the open waters of the Great Salt Lake, depends upon adequate feed for that species. And it grazes the algae, which is created as a result of the presence of nutrients, principally nitrogen and phosphorus. And as the POTWs along the lake are looking at what they need to do to be compliant with the Clean Water Act, they're looking at what they need to do in terms of the treatment and discharge of their nutrients. The North Davis Sewer District has a creative proposal to change its discharge location, and they've been working with Jacobs Engineering, and Jeff Denblaker is here to explain that to us. Go ahead, Jeff.
Great.
Do we have technology yet?
No, we don't.
That's the lake. It's a little purple today.
Yes. That's the lake today. But my name is Jeff Denblaker. I work with Jacobs Engineering. I'm here with Kevin and Myron from North Davis Sewer District. Kevin's the general manager there, and Myron runs the plant. And we've been working with them over the last, I guess, since 2017, looking at just trying to get our arms around the challenges that they have. And in the end, really, as you can see in the agenda, talk about the innovative alternative approach to meeting the nutrient limits that the state has. And in a nutshell, looking at relocating their discharge. Just a brief background on the North Davis Sewer District. They are a district that serves seven cities, two counties. They serve an area of about 80 square miles, 225,000 people, from Lake up to Clinton down to Syracuse, pretty extensive area. Their wastewater drains down to their treatment plant, which is located right on Farmington Bay, just south of Emerald Island Drive, at the causeway that goes out to the island. Their flow rate is, their capacity is 34 million gallons per day, but they typically have an average flow of about 20 to 22 million gallons per day. That represents about 22,000 acre feet of water per year that flows out into Great Salt Lake. Reason why we started this discussion about relocating the outfall was really a factor of, there's a number of factors that really created kind of a perfect storm for them. The number one trigger really forced some action to be taken was the promulgation, the state promulgated new nutrient rules in 2015, saying that all wastewater treatment plants throughout the state needed to meet new phosphorus limits of 1.0 milligrams per liter. And so North Davis Sewer District had to address that and develop a plan for how they were going to do that. If that was it by itself, it would have been relatively straightforward for them. They had to address that with a backdrop of a number of other issues. Number one being just increasing water demands here along the shoreline, along the Wasatch Front. Reuse was certainly part of the conversation with 20 to 25,000 acre feet of water going to Great Salt Lake. That's a real volume of water. And for any water planner looking at a water portfolio, that's something that they would want to consider. And so North Davis over the last 10 years or so has been talking with the irrigation companies, the different cities, the water districts, and how and when their effluent might be reused back into the system. Timing is not now, but the timing is really dependent on the water demands when those come online. There's certainly a cost for the district to treat their effluent to a point where it can be reused, and the price point, the amount of money people are willing to pay for that reused water really is going to depend on supply and demand. When the supply starts to, when we're tapping our supply and but we have more demand coming on, prices of water will likely increase, and it's just a matter of time when that price of water reaches the point where their effluent becomes a very attractive water supply to be used throughout the valley here. The other key component that the district had to address was really looking at Farmington Bay. As you all know, water quality there has been a concern for quite some time. Algae odors from Farmington Bay, anoxic conditions which is the low dissolved oxygen out there, and more recently harmful algal blooms have all been a concern. And so as the district is looking at just this one nutrient limit, this technology-based effluent limit, phosphorus, they also have to consider all the other potential limits that might be coming out. And so for them, they're really considering the fact that because of the harmful algal blooms and other water quality problems, they might be looking at more stringent nutrient limits than just the technology-based limits that they have now. And so all those things together kind of create this perfect storm of sort that the district had to try to resolve as they look at making investments, the investments that they need to make. And so they started in 2017 a master planning process and brought Jacobs on board to help them with that. They had a number of objectives that they wanted to address. Of course, they wanted their facility to be safe, reliable, resilient, robust, durable, sustainable, flexible, all the kind of things that most facilities would want to have. But they also wanted to make sure that they could provide some certainty or have some certainty in their planning process and meeting regulations. Of course, they have to meet the current regulations, but they also need to try to forecast and plan for new regulations that might be coming out. They also wanted to maximize energy, chemical efficiencies, and in the end, we all flush toilets. And so we all pay for the kind of investments that a district like North Davis has to make. And so they want to make sure that what they're doing is providing the maximum value for all the different ratepayers, for the communities, but also for Great Salt Lake. They're very aware that they sit right on the shoreline of Great Salt Lake and wanted to make sure that they are providing maximum value both upstream and downstream. And so as we started the master planning process, with our wastewater engineers, of course, one of the initial solutions was to build a new treatment plant. new water reclamation facility to the tune of another $150 million to do that. But as we started looking at that master plan, at what it would take to build a new treatment plant, we started to ask the question again, well, what about the Great Salt Lake? You know, if we build a new reclamation facility to meet future regulatory requirements, we would most likely be improving the water quality significantly enough where it could be easily reused. And so the reduction or loss of flow to Great Salt Lake, specifically from North Davis Sewer District, is a very real possibility. It's just a matter of timing as to when that actually happens. And so we hit pause, and we said, well, what if we step back and rethink about what we're trying to accomplish? Of course, we want to protect the water quality of Farmington Bay and Great Salt Lake, but we also don't want to shoot ourselves in the foot and treat it to a point where the water gets pulled out of the lake and reused in another way. So we wanted to really look at, well, how can we address the water quality, harmful algal bloom risks without risking the loss of their effluent going to Great Salt Lake? And so that's where the ideas respond. Look at innovative alternative approaches to this. Can we really balance the water quality benefits with other habitat benefits in Great Salt Lake and try to keep address the regulatory requirements that the district has? And boiling it all down, all the discussions that were had, really the alternative that came to the forefront was relocating their outfall from Farmington Bay to the other side of the Antelope Island Causeway, where they would then be discharging into Gilbert Bay. And the reasons why that would work, and the district wouldn't have to do additional treatment of their effluent to do that, is that it would, number one, would completely eliminate their nutrient load from Farmington Bay. The technology-based limits would reduce their nutrient load to Farmington Bay, but relocating it to Gilbert Bay would completely eliminate that from Farmington Bay, and would in theory help Farmington Bay's water quality. Secondly, but then the question is, well, what about Gilbert Bay? Why wouldn't we need to meet the new nutrient limits in Gilbert Bay? It really comes down to the unique chemistry, the salinities of Gilbert Bay that would allow us to discharge at the effluent that they have now into Gilbert Bay without having to do additional nutrient removal. The salinities, the chemistry make Gilbert Bay a lot less sensitive to nutrients. Hypersaline conditions make it so that the toxic cyanobacteria that you read about in the news, you hear about in the news, can't grow in those salinity conditions. Cyanobacteria love salinities from about 1% up to about 5 or 7%. And if Gilbert Bay stays above 7%, then we don't have to worry about those harmful algal blooms in Gilbert Bay. And then we have our friends, the brine shrimp. The brine shrimp graze down the algae every year a couple times. And so even if we have a response to nutrients in Gilbert Bay, that the brine shrimp are grazing them down. And so there's a number of reasons there that where it was acceptable to the Division of Water Quality to be able to discharge to Gilbert Bay without doing additional nutrient removal. But, and I wish this is where I had a map, because when we first started the discussion with Gilbert Bay, we were looking at some of the, this was 3 or 4 years ago, and looking at the satellite imagery there, and the Gilbert Bay pictures still show Gilbert Bay going up to the shoreline, along the east shoreline of Great Salt Lake. But as we started to look at the more recent satellite imagery, aerial imagery, we started to see, you know what, there's a feature that's emerging from the lake as the lake is receding. And what we kind of named it ourselves the Ogden Spur. It's an area, you can picture Fremont Island north of the causeway. There's a natural sandbar that extends from the south tip of the island. It actually extends out into Farmington Bay. There's also a sandbar that extends from the south tip of the island to the east shoreline of Great Salt Lake. And so what happens is that as the lake recedes, that western sandbar that goes through the causeway separates this area of what we call Ogden Spur from Gilbert Bay. It's still part of Ogden Bay, so it's still saline like Ogden Bay and Gilbert Bay, but it's separate. As the lake continues to go down, the second weir sandbar now becomes actually separates Ogden Spur from the lake itself. And so now we have kind of a natural impoundment that's perched up above the lake, and that does still drain to the north to Ogden Bay, but it must have a fresh water source. And so the concern there was, well, if we're discharging just on the north side of the causeway, and we're discharging now into this Ogden Spur area, does the salinity, will the salinity there change in such a way, or we might still have harmful algal blooms? And so in 2018 and 2019, the district's been investing in a number of investigations to try to understand the hydrology, the salinity, the chemistry of what's going on in this Ogden Spur area. And so what we've learned is that, as you all know, the lake is extremely dynamic. And what we've really seen is that we look at the historical record of Great Salt Lake levels, there was a period in the 1960s where Ogden Spur was visible, where it dried out. But it wasn't until these last 5 or 6 years where Ogden Spur has really become a reality again because of where we are with the Great Salt Lake water levels. And so, actually in the last 5 years, Ogden Spur has dried out completely during the usually September, August-September time frame, and creates a salt crust. So if you were able to go back and look at Google Earth, you can see during those fall months, there's actually a salt crust that forms out there because the water evaporates or infiltrates away. And so, but with the information that we had, what we had to do was try to forecast, well, what will happen in this Ogden Spur area in terms of salinity? And also, what would happen if we added North Davis's flow to Ogden Spur as a 24/7 flow into this area? The good news is that it would keep Ogden Spur full of water. It's about 5 square miles. It's a huge area. So it'd stay wet, but stay with surface water in there. But the salinities would likely drop. They would drop down to the 1 to 2% brackish conditions. So there is a risk of harmful algal blooms forming there. There's also a risk, as you know, if we have standing water out there, shallow standing water, phragmites love that. So phragmites would be a challenge that would have to be managed. As well as if we have a freshwater ecosystem like that, the organic matter that would develop from the plants and everything else, you would likely see nutrients start to build up in there. And so now we're all of a sudden back to where we are now in Farmington Bay, where if North Davis is discharging into Ogden Spur, now in 10, 15, 20 years, we might still then be at the point, well, now maybe North Davis needs to increase their treatment, and we move down the road towards reinducing this. And so we wanted to try to look for an alternative where we could avoid that. And so through over the last couple of years, we've been meeting with a number of stakeholders from Great Salt Lake, with state agencies, looking at, well, what can we do? There's 4 or 5 alternatives that we've really been looking at. One is no action. We just stay in Farmington Bay. And there we feel like that's going to end up losing the water to reuse. If we go to the first outfall, which would be located pretty close to the guard shack there on the Antelope Island Causeway, we feel there we have the problems with Ogden Spur and actually having to do additional treatment. Number 2 is where we would look at going to another outfall, a new outfall further down the causeway beyond the sandbar, where we would actually be discharging into Gilbert Bay. And then there was an option where we're doing hybrids, where we're doing seasonal operations, where we're just, during some seasons we're discharging all the way out to Gilbert Bay, some seasons we're discharging Ogden Spur or even to Farmington Bay. And so through all the different evaluations and analyses that we've done, really came down to what is the best solution. We had a number of solutions that we could look at, but we wanted to find what was the best long-term solution for both the district, its ratepayers, and Great Salt Lake. And in the end, where we have been, especially just here in the last 6 months working with the state agencies, is really moved towards an option where we're building a new outfall down the causeway, about 6 miles down the causeway, where we would be discharging actually to Gilbert Bay. We would be bypassing Ogden Spur. We would be discharging into the hypersaline waters of Gilbert Bay. We would keep their existing outfall in Farmington Bay active as part of their discharge permit. And the goal here really is trying to balance the benefits that the new outfalls will provide. We want to make sure we're addressing the water quality concerns for the lake, but also if we move the water out of Farmington Bay completely, we're losing a lot of bird habitat that their effluent currently supports. And so we're trying to find that, where's that sweet spot where we can keep some water going to Farmington Bay during, say, bird migration periods, and maintain the habitat for them, that food source for them during that critical period, but then be able to transport most of the nutrient load, their water, out to Gilbert Bay itself. And so that's really kind of where we are right now. Got a meeting in a couple days with state agencies to continue that discussion. We're hoping here in the next couple months to be able to kind of put a bow on that and decide, okay, you know, we're going to build these out, this new outfall out in Gilbert Bay, and have some better clarity as to how they'll actually be operated in terms of seasonal operations. The board, we want to try to have North Davis Sewer District Board approval here by March, April time frame, so we can submit a final plan to DWQ that would include how, you know, here's the infrastructure that's going to be required, here's how it would be operated, Phragmites control that we would need to do, and then have a new request back to DWQ by the beginning of July, so we can get the discharge permit updated, the variance request updated, and can move into the formal public review process and permitting and design and construction. The goal is to have it operational, the new outfall operational by January 1st, 2023. So we've got a few years still to do that. And I guess one of our objective, especially just coming here today, is to make sure everybody's aware of it, because this, you know, even as we started looking at these concepts a few years ago, you know, it certainly seemed to make sense, but there's a lot of different perspective expertise that the Great Salt Lake community provides, and really has helped make this what is going to be the best solution for their outcome. And so in the end, we'll be able to meet or improve the water quality in Farmington Bay, Gilbert Bay, be able to preserve the bird habitat and meet the district's regulatory requirements, and hopefully keep their effluent going into Great Salt Lake for a longer period of time. So,
thank you, Jeff. Let's go to the council first. Any questions, comments from council members? Dan.
Great show. It's the best blue I've seen for a long time. So if you're going to put it out in front of Fremont Island, is that it's going to come to the road, and then it's going to go that way to the Ogden Spur. So how deep is that going to be?
The pipeline?
No, by inches.
Oh, well, will not be discharging to Ogden Spur. The concept right now is that the pipeline will go north along the fence line to Antelope Island Drive, right by the garbage shack there, the parking lot. It'll stay along the north edge of asphalt, along the causeway, and it's going to go straight down the causeway about 6 miles to that point where we get past that sandbar, and then it'll emerge out of the side of the causeway to the north where it'll discharge out into Gilbert Bay.
So that just past the bridge?
No, it's before the bridge. Yep. About a mile and a half east of the bridge. The causeway's a really long. So it's a considerable distance. But right now, you know, I mean, our intent is to have the invert of the pipeline at least a foot or two below the current lake level. And hopefully the lake level is gonna stay, or we hope it goes up. But the intent is to be able to discharge to the open water of Great Salt Lake, or Gilbert Lake.
Other council members, Dave and then Tom?
A little bit more about your estimates for the loss of bird habitat in Farmington Bay. Obviously, the balancing act you described is a little fuzzy to me. If you take 22,000 acre feet out of Farmington Bay and moving it to, what does that do to the wetlands in Farmington Bay?
Mm-hmm. Well, right now, there's about 550 acres of Phragmites downstream of, the district discharges into an irrigation return canal. So there's between 5 and 10 CFS of continuous flow down that canal, even without their effluent. That ditch, that dip or that canal then goes onto the mud flats, goes through the stand of Phragmites, and then depending on lake level, there's mud flat and vegetation downstream of that. Right now, there's probably, including the Phragmites, there's about 1,200 acres of wet mud flat from that water. It depends on the lake level. I think the water level in Farmington Bay is much more a factor of Gilbert Bay or the Great Salt Lake overall. Their flow certainly contributes, but there's that flow also exits into Gilbert Bay, about as fast as it comes in. And so in terms of the open water area in Farmington Bay, I don't think there's a way, it would be minimal, negligible difference in open water area. The area we've been discussing has really been that mud flat area, and what can we do to do that? So that's where we're looking at potential of discharging out of their existing outfall during the migratory season, August, September, to keep that area wet long enough where food can, the bugs can come back, birds can find the bugs there during that period. But also trying to balance that with trying to minimize the amount of load, nutrient load that's going into Farmington Bay. And so there, this coming season, starting this spring, we're going to be looking at the hydrology of their existing outfall much more closely. Just trying to understand if we were to produce, discharge 20%, if the canal was to discharge by itself, how much of that mud flat would stay wet? What if we didn't have the Phragmites there? And you take the Phragmites out, all of a sudden you've got 500 acres of new habitat. So there's a number of things that we're talking through right now and try to figure out, and really I think it's a policy question of, we want to minimize the nutrient loads into Farmington Bay, and we can do that easily. We can eliminate them by discharging out to Gilbert Bay. But we also recognize we want to preserve that existing bird habitat as much as we can. So where is that sweet spot of how much water for how long do we need to keep those mud flats wet?
Tom and then Joe.
Jeff, you mentioned one of the elements or thought processes of the district, and I think water quality is, if you treat it to a level where that water can be just used, reused, then that takes that resource away from the lake. I know at one point the state was looking at existing statutory regulatory framework that would allow a dedication of the water, the current water rights, if the district and the cities agree that water could go to reuse, right? And in this permitting process, it might be a solution that lasts a couple decades, but if the next step is in 30 years, that water ends up being reused and sent upstream. The question I have for the district and the DWQ would be, if this permitting phase gives certainty to the district as well as certainty to the lake management, the dedication of that water is part of the overall permitting process. And so there's two parts of the question. Has that been discussed? And second, does DWQ feel like they have regulatory and legal framework to make that happen or not? I didn't see Eric or anyone else. Is DWQ here?
Ben and I are here, but do you want to answer the first part of that question?
We have looked at it. The district, as well as the State Division of Wildlife Resources, have secondary water rights on the effluent. Wildlife Resources, the first 20 CFS is for wildlife reserve purposes on the mud flats on the shoreline there. And then the district has the next 8 CFS. That they can use for secondary water purposes. I think what it comes down to is who owns the primary, the water rights themselves. And so that's I think, as far as the conversation has gone in terms of those water rights is, and the district really is not in control of those.
The current statute, a water right holder can't pull it out from the district. The statute requires the sewer district and the water right holder to have an agreement, and absent that agreement, the statute doesn't allow the use of that water. it goes to the system, if you will. So I think there is some ability within the framework of the permitting process and the current ownership of the treatment facilities to make that commitment. It hasn't been tested, to my knowledge, in the state in terms of water rights legislation specifically allocating that, but I think there's enough tools in the legal and regulatory framework to make that happen. And so I guess I would just offer as a, well, Leland knows more than me and he's shaking his head.
I just think that it would be very difficult for the state to write a permit which required the district to not enter into an agreement with one of their customer agencies. I think you'd have some real major hurdles that would entail.
If I hear correctly, the state is being asked to entertain, you know, an outfall that would provide at least a temporary benefit and management tool, but there's no certainty of that. And what is certain is the value of water is going to increase. And so if the state, back to, you know, Jeff and the district's original premise, I've worked in the wastewater industry myself. If you treat it to a certain level, it becomes a resource that's, from a financial perspective, quite a lot of states are moving to Florida, Texas, and all even Tooele
for using water. And one of the studies we're working on that we just got back the proposals on yesterday is to look at what legal framework needs to be changed in order to make something like what you're suggesting legal under the current law, under the law.
Right.
So what we're looking at is how can we make changes within the existing code to allow for a dedication of water to the lake.
So the district saves money, the water can go there, and there's
right. Certainty
for all parties that are
right.
entering into
and
it.
That's part of the current study that we're okay. that's underway right now.
Okay.
So the concept's been floated. Let's take the rest of that offline and go to Joe. And then after that, we'll take one question from the rest of the attendees.
Is there a gain of volume getting to the lake if the water's not flowing over the shallow mud flat, as you characterized it? It seems that would be susceptible to evaporation in summer months. Is that, have you
yeah.
looked at that?
Yep, for sure. I think, than before Christmas, that spreadsheet. I want to say as at least a third of their effluent is probably taken up either through the vegetation or just straight evaporation before it even gets to the lake. So certainly, they're, you know, if we're discharging directly into the open water, we gain that.
Any other questions from the council? If not, anyone else have a quick question?
What was the same as?
40.
Last question.
Just curious, with the modeling that you've done, with that discharge point being moved out there, would that be kind of like a local effect, or you know, what kind of dispersion of the water? You know, so you're trying to support the branch of the population in the lake. Would this be kind of more of a local effect, or would it disperse and dissolve, you know, further out into the lake?
I think. Well, right at the end of the outfall, needed the local effect. I think I was talking to Wayne Wurzbaugh, and what he was finding is that even the water coming out through the bridge from Farmington Bay within a kilometer, they were really discerning the difference in slimming in that area. So we expect, you know, if it's a really calm day, the fresher water, you know, will take a longer time to disperse, but, you know, with any kind of wind event, it's going to mix.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. And thanks to the district for taking the time and resources to think outside the box, or in this case, outside the bay, so to speak. Okay, our next agenda item is a presentation regarding the Bear River Development Project. As you know, in 1991, the Utah Legislature passed the Bear River Development Act, and planning and studies for the development of storage of the Bear River have been ongoing for decades. The threshold we have here is a feasibility study that was completed and published late last year, and Marisa Egbert is here to give us a quick overview of that, and again, I apologize for the technology glitch.
My technology is just
from Santa. All right.
I will say that the group next door is a lot more fun. Just saying. They're reading some really good books over there, and I think they're allowed to get up and move around a lot. So.
It's probably a video, too.
Yeah, right? Now that I've done a lot of door duty and getting churned over there. So. But thank you for letting me be here today, and sorry we don't have this up. Quite a few of you in this room have seen this presentation, or this presentation. And the feasibility study that was just completed is really some digging deeper into, no pun intended, digging deeper into the 2014 report that looks at possibilities for large diameter pipeline corridors as well as potential reservoir sites. And in this study, we took about 46 sites that looked like possibilities for possible reservoir storage and narrowed those down to seven sites that were looked at further, one of which is Washakie that had already been looked at in more depth in 2010. One thing that we always talk about is Bear River Development Act, Utah Code 73-26. Telling the Division of Water Resources to study and plan. It also talks about develop, it also says to develop the future project in the meantime to study and plan, and that's what's going on at this stage with how far we are out at this time. And for those that aren't aware, the Bear River Development Act says to develop 220,000 acre feet of water for the Cache County, Box Elder County, Weber Davis, and Salt Lake counties through four water districts, being Bear River Water Conservancy District, Box Elder County, what is now Cache Water District in Cache County, Weber Basin Water Conservancy District for Weber and Davis, and Jordan Valley Water Conservancy District for down in the South Salt Lake County area. And so those are the four entities that we've been working with projections on need, projections on their supply, and working with them over these years to look forward on this planning. And it's been amazing to watch this project go from, well, I didn't watch it in 1991 because I was still in school. I'll throw that out for a few of you. But the need for it back then was 2015. And that has come and gone. But I have watched the need for the project when I first started working on this a decade ago. A decade ago, we were thinking 2030. And we were in a little bit of a panic of how to do something like this in 20 years. We were talking about years of an environmental process and then design and construction. And so now we're looking at 2050 and beyond. And this has been concerted effort by the districts to find other ways to be more efficient, find other through conservation, through water efficiency projects. Smart meters is the big thing in Davis and Weber counties at this time, so these are some of the things. I should watch my time. Dawn 11, or do you want me to stop a little before 11?
11 will give us maybe a few minutes before.
Okay, gotcha. I can do that. And so, talking about especially just really quickly on the secondary meters in Davis and Weber County, just alone putting those secondary meters on, they put about a third on their system. They have not changed their rates at this time. They are still charging the same as they don't have everybody on the meters. But they have seen as much as 40% reduction just in educating people in their bills, saying this is how much you're using and this is how much you really should be using. They have received a Water Smart grant, and they've also are looking to our division, the Division of Water Resources, for funding for these water meters. Just the meter alone is about $500, but when you talk installation and you're going in someone's backyard to install and retrofit, the average cost they're saying is about $1,500 per connection to put those on. So you multiply $1,500 by 17,000 connections, and that's a lot of zeros. And they are doing what they can on that. Additionally, Jordan Valley Water Conservancy District spends, I'm looking at Richard and Allen right now, about $1.5 million annually on water conservation efforts at this time. And they have done a fantastic job and also pushed out that need in their area for the Bear River Development Project. So the current feasibility study, like I said, going off the 2014 concept report, pipeline concept report, which is on our website, and I would show you. But if you go to our website, water.utah.gov, you go across the top and it says projects, and you click on that underneath it says Bear River Development. And so it'll have this feasibility study, the 2014 feasibility study, and all of that, and even the fund appendix that we only made 5 copies of because it was pretty big and it's pretty boring except to maybe like Christian and Greg. It has a lot of scientific stuff. But the current feasibility study looked at 13 scenarios, taking combinations of these. We actually looked at this more specifically 6 reservoir sites. The 7th one would be Washakie, and Washakie is very similar to some of the others. But 13 scenarios and with combinations of how would the water even be able to be developed. And only a few of those scenarios even work, even provide a reliable supply from year to year for the water districts based on their needs, because as you know, the Bear River is incredibly, incredibly variable. And we've even seen over the last 30 years a reduction in the average, whereas it used to be 1 million acre feet, that was the data set we used 10 years ago. The data set we've moved to now to update is about 800,000 acre feet, but that's on average. So you're gonna have your bad years, you're gonna have your high years. So on these sites, we did a little bit more when you're out in the field and actually did some drilling for some soil to kind of look and see what would even work to help come up with cost estimates. Because when you have a project like this, the first question I usually get is, what is the cost? So you have to study it. It also looked at potential, zoomed in a little bit more on some of the potential right-of-way corridors for a large diameter pipeline. We updated the hydrology, as I just mentioned, for the modeling. We did some preliminary look at climate change modeling, which is very difficult this far out, but that is also in the study. And then we have a discussion in one chapter on the Great Salt Lake and the potential impacts on the Great Salt Lake. And that talks about a lot of the white paper that came out that Craig Miller worked on, Wayne Wurzbach worked on, and talking about those impacts. That being said, it doesn't say how to mitigate. We are so far out in this process at this time, it does not go to that, into those details. So some of the big takeaways of what came out of this newer feasibility study, and specifically with the updated data and the updated modeling, is because of the reduced flow and the variability in the Bear River, as much as 600,000 acre feet of storage, actually a bit more than 600,000 acre feet of storage is needed to be able to carry over through the drought years to supply a reliable supply to the water districts. They can't have 1 year and have plenty of water and then the next year not have enough. So that's what the point of the reservoirs are, to reserve that water and hold on to it to be able to use it for the drought years. The other takeaway is that of all those 6 sites that we looked at and did combinations, the only combinations that work are ones with White's Valley. White's Valley is a site north of I-84, north of Powell, and it's very large and can hold us as much as 600,000 acre feet itself. The difficult part with White's Valley is there's not a river running through it. But that being said, there's not a river running through it, so there's good and bad on all of these scenarios. So water would have to be pumped north, and it would have to be pumped up 1,000 feet in elevation to be able to make White's Valley work. Because all of the cheapest sites and all of the cheapest water has been developed at this point. So thus, it gets more and more expensive. And then the other is the corridor preservation through Box Elder County in particular. The concern about needing as much as 100 feet of right-of-way to be able to construct a large diameter with the type of equipment that you need, and to have what's called open trench construction, and then to have maintenance thereafter. And the purpose of that right now is this, as we all drive through Box Elder County and look at Willard Bay on our left immediately, and immediately on our right, the houses is trying to squeeze in there somehow, which is also what UTA is trying to do. Utah Transit Authority is trying to slip through there as well. And so we have been working with them since 2018, signed an agreement and working on shared corridor just east of the existing railroad to try to reduce impacts to the neighboring community. And this is all willing seller at this point. If people don't want to sell, we're fine. I certainly don't want the state to own any homes for 30, 40 years. So we're happy to wait. So just give you some estimate of some construction costs. And Thane Clark from Bowen Farms can raise his hand and yell at me if I get this wrong. About $10 million a mile of pipeline, which is a lot. But then UTA laughs at me when I say that, because they're like 50, 60 for a mile of railroad. The reservoirs range from 35 million to 350 million. And the current cost estimate, we have a range of 1.7 to 2.8 billion. And the interesting part is the most expensive scenarios actually don't supply that give the reliable supply. Those reservoirs that are smaller have to be huge dams, huge spillways, are very expensive, very difficult to build. White's Valley is a more traditional type dam site, and so it's not as expensive. And so actually the scenarios that work are on the lower range of $1.7 to $2 billion. That being said, it's capital costs. That is construction only. The water districts will then have to pay for their own local distribution system, which Jordan Valley's been working on right away preservation for about 15, 20 years now to stay ahead of houses. Same thing, there's water treatment and there's O&M. So the big takeaway that I don't think I'll surprise too many people is this is going to be very expensive. It's not only capital costs, there will have to be mitigation costs, which we have not estimated. We've done some very high level look at mitigation costs to when we were trying to figure out which reservoir sites to look at, but that has not been looked at in detail, and I'm sure that will be very expensive. And so it will be expensive water, which is why the districts are working so hard to find other ways to provide water to this growing population that they see coming into their areas. And I just, one other really good thing in that, if you look up the Bear River Development Act, it's really not that long to look it up. It, near the end of it, in 504, 503, 505, so it's Utah Code 73-26-503 to 505 talks about repayment. The districts will repay this. They'll repay the construction and the mitigation costs. And it says construction environmental mitigation costs affected to M&I uses shall be entirely repaid by the entities contracting for that water for those uses. And then the full cost of operation, maintenance, repair, and replacement allocated for these uses shall be charged to the entities contracting. So this is something that will be repaid to the state. And one other thing in 505 is that it will be repaid with interest. Right now, the Development Act also says it'll be repaid within 50 years or not more than 50 years. That's two of the things that it says. So it's looking at a 50-year repayment. So that's, Don, I think I went over a little because that's what I do. Oh, my phone says 10:59.
You're good.
So that's all she got right now.
All right, thank you very much, Marisa. Yeah. Let's start with council members' questions. Leland, Jeff, Tom, Joe, Dave.
So I know that this is a report on the project feasibility and study like that. But, you know, we've just, and I know that the white paper, if I remember correctly, talking about the impact of this to the lake is like 1 foot. The dilemma we face is we've done modeling for Great Salt Lake now, which if we don't do something significantly different, and what the problem that I personally have is that the Bear River project is one which trends to indicate that we don't need to change dramatically. But from the lake standpoint, the model suggests that business as usual with growth and with climate variability is going to drop the lake almost 11 feet. over that same period of time, you'd be wanting to work on this project and get it done.
You mean the 11 feet since
there's 11
Sully
feet we've
Valley
lost
was...
already. That's
right,
the model
okay.
suggesting.
Okay.
The yeah. historic record suggests we've lost 11 feet.
Mm-hmm.
This would be 11 feet more. If you look at the Jacobs report and you look at the modeling that we did, if we do lots of nice conservation and everything else, but not severe conservation, we're losing 5 feet, 4 to 5 feet. But without a change in paradigm, if we try and support existing water uses the way we have in the past, used it, the overall impact to the lake is 11 feet. And that's where this construct of taking out water reuse and everything else is going to support that kind of, will fuel that kind of continuous water use. And so I guess the question is there an attempt to, with the parallel to this report, to look at what it would take to support growth within our existing water infrastructure and water supply? In other words, let's suggest what we have to do so that we don't have to develop these projects which have severe impact on the Great Salt Lake. This and other projects. Is there an attempt to do that? To say, what would it take to live within our existing water supply?
And I think that's part of what I feel that's what the districts have been working on. The fact that it's gone from a 2015 expectation in 91 to now 2015 beyond, so 35 years.
But that still is saying we're going to need it because we're going to need it. And I'm suggesting, is there any work being done to say, because the public doesn't know what that change would be to live within existing water supply. Public doesn't see that. They just see a report saying we need to build a Bear River project. And we've saved water, so we haven't. And I applaud the water districts for doing what they've done so far. But, you know, the modeling we suggest, in order to stay even close to where we would be today if you didn't see any growth, or you didn't see climate variability, suggests you're going to be going down to 10, 20% turf compared to where we've been now, where we are now. And so, but I don't see being produced a report anywhere that says, here's how we can do this within our existing water supply and not sacrifice the lake as the solution to growth.
The division works in a few different areas when we talk about not just looking at developing new water, the conservation efforts. I tried to get an answer whether or not, I'm trying to look, let me see if I got someone. Hang on. No. Let me just, sorry. The division did get, I think, $500,000 in last fiscal year, finally, towards conservation from the legislature. That's the first time we've been able to get that. And the other thing is fiscal year 2018, $21 million out of our revolving funds that have already been appropriated by the legislature. There is continuous that also comes through sales tax. Those have been put towards water efficiency projects also. I don't know what the protocol is. I mean, I've got Richard Bay or Alan Packard who would be able to probably better answer that specific question. I don't know if it's
well,
part of a rhetorical.
I'm suggesting, and I guess maybe I'm posing a question, which is really a suggestion.
Okay.
I believe the division needs to look at what it takes to live within existing water supplies to handle growth and climate variability. I mean, I think that that's a study that needs to be done and looked at to say, what would that take? And then is this something that we can actually tolerate or sell to the public? Because this, the alternative is still the lake suffers.
Yep.
And that's what's going to happen with this if we don't change our paradigm sooner than later. Because every new house being built on 8,000 to 12,000 square foot lots with that much grass is going to continue to utilize a lot more water than we have availability of.
So I like your idea. I wrote it down and double underlined it.
So if that's a motion, I'll second
it. After it too?
Quick,
can I answer the question just briefly?
Yeah.
In terms of the environmental studies that will happen as part of this project, yes, Leland, those studies will be done because we will look at a no, an option to not have the project, right? The environmental studies will require the state look at how could we survive without this project, right? And the environmental assessment and all the environmental requirements that are going to go into this project, that option will be looked at.
So if it doesn't down the road, I'm suggesting that this needs to be done today as an alternative that goes on the table to allow people to understand that there are, there is an alternative, and what do we have to do to achieve that alternative? I mean, I understand you guys are going to dot the I's and cross the T's, you're going to do the job right, and I'm not questioning that. I'm just questioning, is there a way to get that information out so we can alert, we can show whether or not it's even possible, number one, you know? I mean, it's a significant change. There'd have to be lots of work done to make this happen. But what was that? What additional amount would have to be done to do that? That's my suggestion, is that we do that. And I would actually make a motion that we suggest that that study be done. There's something to this effect. We put on the table to say, we need to look at what the alternative is. And we don't do that. We talk about it in terms of the words conservation. I'm on a podium right now, not asking a question. Sorry.
Let's come back to your motion second after
can
other
I say
members have commented. Two words.
I agree.
One, two. Yes. you had to use a contract.
I can't say I or that I second the motion.
Hey Jeff, do you remember what you were going to ask?
Vaguely, no. Obviously, it's been pushed back a couple of times due to conservation, and I agree. I mean, I think that's wonderful. We need to go that route. If it does look like this is going to become necessary, given your existing timeline, how far in advance would you have to start doing the environmental studies, get all the mitigation done, look at pre-construction, the planning, so that you can pull the trigger so it would be done at X date? Are you talking 3 years, 15?
We're looking along those lines of 20. Richard, Alan, you've been involved with this. Does 20 sound like a good number? That being said, in the last 10 years, our target has moved out on us again. But we've talked anywhere from 7 to 10 years for the environmental process, and another 5, 7 to 10 years for design and construction. So yeah, a project like this would need to, it is going to take a long time to get to. Yeah, good question.
Joe, you were next.
Yeah.
No question. Any other questions? Dan?
Did he bring chocolate cake donuts? Because he didn't bring chocolate cake.
I did.
Okay, all right.
They were just all taken before the box got to you. Dan, do you have a comment or question?
Well, with all this planning, projection and guesstimation. If you look at what's in the news, the Salt Lake Tribune had an article about 2 Sundays ago that said that 90% of this dust in the Arquette Valley is from dry lake beds. If you look out at the Mill Lake, there's no lake. There's a little bit.
Yeah.
It's more of a stream. So if you look into the future, you don't really know what's there. You're just guessing. But when you have to pay it back, and that's for the next meeting, I think, we'll have a rebuttal to the payment on that. But I just think if you conserve, and the worst example of all is the Capitol grounds. If you want people to conserve and do xeriscape and stuff, xeriscape has two different meanings to some people. One is doing desertscape, and the other is do nothing. And so you have weeds and all this other junk in there. But the public needs to know exactly what they're going to face, because in 2050, it's going to cost a whole lot more.
Thanks, Dan.
I agree again.
Go ahead, Tom, quickly.
Quick question on the calculation of the 11 inches of, if you're taking 220,000 acre feet and saying only 85,000 acre foot is withdrawal, the rest is return to the system. I'll go back to the same question I asked at North Davis and Jeff Denblaker was, does the water resources have a dedication of water rights that will go to environmental flows that will go to the lake. Because absent that...
Environmental?
Right, so you're...
No,
you're,
what did you say?
The water that's diverted to Jordan Valley, Weaver Basin, and the other districts, if it goes to M&I, that water right can be used 100% consumption under current Utah statute. So to say that you only have 85,000 acre foot of withdrawal is not accurate. It's not accounting for eventually someone using that reuse water. And so what I would proffer is maybe using, if the project proceeds, at least doing something like they did with the Central Utah Completion Act, where under the federal environmental framework, they require the dedication of water flow to the environment, to the lake, so that that water that's managed in the upper reservoirs for a dry year, some of that's dedicated, they will end up through the duck clubs, into the bays, and out to the aquaculture, and it could potentially actually be a benefit to lake management. But absent that, guaranteed in 50 years, that reuse water, it won't be an 85,000 acre foot and 11 inches. It will be more like 2-3 feet in the full withdrawal without a decision at this point at that level.
Thank
and
you, Tom.
The 85,000 acre feet was based on current return flow calculations.
But the statutes.
Oh, I know.
So let's take one or two really quick questions from non-council members. Or none.
Okay.
White Valley is north and east of Tremont? North and west, excuse me?
Yes.
That was a quick question. Thank you, Tom.
Does that get answered?
The response of this gentleman over here, we understand the statute says that there's no return flows, but there are return flows when people use it for landscaping. It's going to be similar to agriculture. So to assume that there are no return flows, even if they do reuse, it's just not a factual reality.
If you look at Phoenix, they've gone from turf to painted dirt, and they're consuming it all, and then they're reusing it.
All right, let's move on here, should we?
Does that mean you're done with me?
No. Yeah, I think so. Appreciate it.
And Don, if I may, just a couple sentences. That's the hard part. Where all of us in this room are is we're not developing new water. It's just water in different ways of using it. And any way to become more efficient, reuse, all these things that even 10 years ago looked like really good ideas, it's just moving water in a different way. So it's tough.
Don, I'm going to ask
you. Go ahead, Tom.
I'll offer up a project that I've seen in other states where you take a water development project, the water that actually is new water, so you take a circle pivot and improve the efficiency. That's water that's going to go to the atmosphere, maybe up in Colorado or something else. That's new water. And so as the state looked at it, as opposed to a Bear River project, investing $2.5 billion in retrofitting all of our agricultural infrastructure so the efficiency improves. That's new water captured out of the atmosphere, and that water can go towards ag, to M&I, to environmental uses, and no one is harmed. In fact, an irrigation company is going to save on their power costs from pumping, fertilizers, herbicides, and all those other costs. So it becomes one of those win-win-win solutions. So the problem becomes bigger, the solution becomes bigger, but the benefits become magnified.
And the division has invested a lot of money in funding, funding towards those efficiency projects. And then you find out that the user downstream, not really, their well starts going dry. So you can become more efficient. And right now, Utah Water Right Law allows for that water to stay still with that irrigation company. So they become more efficient, but now they can water later in the season. Does that make sense?
Let Joe have the last word here.
What's the status of the water right that was applied for in your...
Bear Lake? I don't know. That is not part of this. No, there's the state has, I think, 5 water rights that have been there for river development, but the Bear Lake one is not for this. And I can't speak to that.
I can't.
There's Craig.
The analysis has to be done. What we're modeling right now, how much additional water there might be able to be stored on Bear Lake. It's nowhere near 400,000 acre feet.
and we're not really analyzing yet how it's going to be used, but that analysis of how much water there actually can be stored there should be complete first, and then after that, we haven't been told what will happen, but that analysis has to be completed first. And it should be complete sometime in March. The report should be out. So after that, sometime something will happen, but I'm not sure what.
If I recall, the state of Idaho was a proponent as well. Are you working
with that? My understanding is the state of Idaho was planning to file and asked the state of Utah if they wanted to file with them. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Marisa, thanks. Thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation and the questions. Next item on the agenda.
My motion.
Oh, I was going to hold it to the action.
Okay, never mind. I'm holding.
Okay.
Hey, Don, just a point of order on that, though. You know, our statutory charter divides DNR and DOUQ. I think that's a very valid. I don't know if your motion was made in jest.
No, it wasn't.
Here, I'm just going to
hold
it until
we still make the motion.
Until the section on council deliberations and action. Yeah. I think it's very valid. Sorry I didn't explain that to the group. Next item, public comment. We always reserve time in our meeting for public comment. I'd ask for a raise of hands to see how many people want to comment to determine how to allocate the time. Lynn?
Yes, okay.
You got 3 minutes, Lynn.
Okay, it's just really an announcement to remind you all that we have another Great Salt Lake Issues Forum coming up on May 6th through the 8th. The title of the program is Great Salt Lake, The Gift That Keeps On Giving, Just Add Water. We are going to take advantage of the traction that has come from the commission studies that the Advisory Council has been responsible for helping us to better understand consequences of drying systems, impacts from declining lake level economically, and the integration of the Great Salt Lake Integrated Model and the Integrated Resource Management Model and what that tells us. So I'm very excited. I hope you will be too, and we'll be inviting people to consider sponsorship.
Dates again?
Thank you.
Lynn, the dates again?
Dates.
Oh, it's on May 6th through the 8th at the University of Utah.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, we'll close the public comment period. Let's move to agenda, the 1110 item, member recommendations and actions. We have pending a motion in regard to the need for a study on what would be required under the current paradigm of water supply. Leland, you want to explain that?
Yes, I would make the motion that the Great Salt Lake Council work with the Division of Water Resources and others to develop and prepare a study that would provide the understanding of what would be necessary for the growth and for the climate variability projections to be met within existing water supplies. In other words, what does it take to do what we need to do with growth and otherwise, and yet stay within our existing water supplies? And the study could be done, and we would actively, I think, as a council, advise that this study needs to be done and participate in that study in order to put that information out to the public and on the table.
Okay. And we had a second from Dave. Any discussion or debate about the motion? Let's go to a vote. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? It's unanimous. Congratulations. Okay.
I'm going to offer another similarly aligned recommendation to the Division of Water Resources that they evaluate the potential for capturing lost water to the atmosphere through agricultural efficiency improvements, and what that event and how much additional water supply can be added to Utah's water management portfolio, and that be part of the equation of looking at the next water supplies. And I think the difference that I want to make people understand is it's not water that is return flow right now. And that is one of the benefits. I mean, the gentleman earlier mentioned that you have, you're taking from someone. I've done agricultural engineering. You take a circle pivot and the water's going to the atmosphere, the wind blows it off, nobody gets that water. So to capture that, it actually has no impact to an existing user. So it's a benefit. So that investment is actually creating new water in Utah.
So I have a question. My understanding was the legislature, in fact, allocated and appropriated some funding for agricultural conservation optimization.
So they're looking at optimization, but the question is, how can that be used to support growth? Right now, it's just an idea out there. It doesn't have a place in our water master planning and from a Division of Water Resources. So how does that stack up against Bear River Project or others? And my experience as an engineer in other states, it actually was far more advantageous to do that, but it requires a movement at a state level. Jordan Valley and Weber Basin can't make that happen. Water Resources and the governor and the legislature.
And I take no exception to the substance of what you're proposing. I agree with it. I'm just questioning whether it's already being done.
To a degree, it is. They're looking at ways of using agricultural water in such a way that it reduces depletion. And so we're hoping to get some results from those studies. I don't know when, but it's an ongoing process at this time with a number of state agencies and other organizations participating.
But Craig, it's a little bit different in the sense that the framework I'm talking about is if I'm a water district, if I go spend $100 million on agricultural infrastructure, I get a right to recover that water and then divert that. So it gives me the tools as a water manager. Alan or Richard, if they're still here, it looks like they're gone. They need to have a, I spend this, I get that. So it's looking at the projects and the legal framework and support of the state at the legislative level to make.
They're looking at all of that.
Okay. I know Tim Hawks is, Representative Hawks is involved.
I'm going to ask Tim to comment on that.
Okay, yeah. I would just say, I think it's there's similar issues, but it's through a different lens.
Okay, right?
And to a different purpose. If I understand, you're asking, so there's a legal overlay to what you're talking about, and also how does it relate to, potentially, to the Bear River Project, whereas the current optimization is really just looking at optimization
for a farmer,
kind of for its own sake, right? When what can you conserve? How much does it cost? What is it?
So I'm saying it should be part of our water resources plan.
Okay.
So a study that shows development of agricultural optimization to meet our water resources need and provide for growth without development of new water resources.
Okay.
You know that. If we got some bit of write-up on it, that we could possibly include that with the legal study that we're just getting ready to award.
Okay.
To put so into that package of what
I'm do this. Discuss. I'll back off because I know Representative Fox, there's a lot of other stuff going on. I'll talk to the representative and maybe Craig and some others and get something to you.
If we put something in
sooner
there,
the better.
Add to that assessment that we're doing right now, what legal changes would need to do that.
Okay.
Hey, great, Tom. Thank you. Thank you. Others? So at the September meeting, at the September meeting, you authorized our research committee to pursue several avenues for utilization of the appropriated annual appropriation for this year. As a result of that, we have, I believe the contract is complete, and as you know, we've tried to leverage our money so that we weren't the sole contributor to these things. The contract's been completed, I believe, or very near complete with USGS and several other agencies to address a lack of data regarding nutrient loading and cycling in the lake. There's a RFQ that's gone out, and the contract will be selected next week to look at the highest priority of the 72 strategies, water for the lake, and determine what would be required to implement them, what legal changes, what would be necessary, what are the steps to implement these highest priority projects. We're in discussions with the Division of Water Resources. At the last meeting, we talked about GSLIM and what's the next steps, and you identified several possibilities. One of those was to try to get a more full handoff to Division of Water Resources of that, and we're in conversations with the new director there, and quite optimistic we'll be able to pursue that or move that forward. And then lastly, there's and this is probably beyond the scope of what you approved, and so I would ask for some support today. As you know, HCR 10 established a state policy of trying to preserve lake levels, Great Salt Lake levels, and established a state policy to take that into consideration with other state actions. And it also required by October of 2020 a report back to the legislature on the ways in which this could be accomplished. And there have been several ideas discussed about how to accomplish this. One was some of the agencies thought, well, we'll just circulate an email asking our people to tell us what they think. We thought it needed a broader and more serious look than that, and have suggested that they put together a group of interests to get together and advise the two department heads on which strategies should be pursued. In order to do that effectively and efficiently, we believe there needs to be some staffing support and facilitation. We've talked with the new department director of natural resources about possibly supplying a modest amount of money, maybe $25,000, to staff and facilitate getting that report ready for the legislature. But we think by doing that, we'll have a better, broader, more creative report, if you will. And so that last item, there's enough money remaining in the current year appropriation to do that if we can pull that off, but I need your support to be able to follow through on that.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Any abstentions? It's unanimous. Okay, Leland, fire away.
One thing, it's come to our attention through several different folks that there might be a potential to work this year on achieving some budgetary allowance for having staffing for the council and a position to act as a Great Salt Lake coordinator, if you will. We wanted to see if that was something the council was supportive of, if given that opportunity, if we could then proceed with making a recommendation that we think it's an important thing to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Well, currently we have great folks at DWQ and state forestry, fire, state lands who have very little time to dedicate to us, but they do the best they can. What we're talking about is a position that would spend much more time Great Salt Lake centric.
So this is a discussion topic for future meetings, or?
It's going to go this session possibly. So we just need to get we can't take an action on it because we don't have it on an agenda, but we need to get a consensus of the council as to whether or not they support such an action.
So just quick background, 4 years ago the council approved a recommendation that an individual be hired to be a Great Salt Lake coordinator and to staff us, the Salinity Advisory Committee, the Great Salt Lake Technical Team, and deal with the Great Salt Lake Management Plan within the Department of Natural Resources. That we were not able to get that done principally because at the department level there was opposition at the top of the department to doing so. And the Forestry, Fire, and State Lands Agency has tried to get it included within the budget, the governor's budget, and has been unsuccessful. There's been a change at the top of that department and a belief that there'd be a more receptive response. The challenge this year is the governor's budget's gone forward without it, so it may be much more difficult this year. But I think the idea is to renew our recommendation so we can at least start the process of discussing it this year and see if we can make it happen. And if not, there's great confidence that we can get it in the governor's budget next year and actually get it done. And what's happened is the staff support we have is great, but their burdens are increasing. We've all but lost Laura. We get a smidgen of her time because of other things she's been assigned to do. And so I think it's just time to come back and revisit that need.
So that would be under Fire Force, still Fire Force Estate Lands is where that would reside.
Well, Forest and Fire Estate Lands would like it to reside there.
But that person could coordinate directly with water resources and water rights.
For the whole department, so there's some conversation as to whether it ought to be at a higher level.
In all likelihood, it'd come out of the restricted fund, which would be dovetailed into forestry fire arena. Yeah. So yeah, most likely.
Dan.
So the money we get every year now for fracking is the $500,000. Can you take some of that to pay that position?
I think we have as good a shot at getting other money as we do robbing from Peter to pay Paul. Personal view, but a good thought. I think we can get it incremental.
That'd be plan B.
Or at least you get Paul.
Is there any opposition among council members to the concept of pursuing funding for Grace Lake Coordinator within the Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands?
Not necessarily opposition. The only concern that I would have is if it would come from existing funding that's coming to the council to look at conservation methods and other things. If it was in addition to and it didn't come from those resources, I would be okay with it. But if it comes from existing, I don't know if that would be the best deal.
I agree with you. Great comment.
Do you need a motion?
I think we could use a motion.
I'll second Jeff's motion. I'll make that motion.
Tom's second.
I'll second it if someone hasn't already.
Any debate or discussion, David?
Past years we've had some discussion about kind of a legislative agenda that isn't just like one topic, but it's a package. And I mean, I'm for this, obviously, but I guess we're kind of out of town at the time. But there are other issues, fact mining, there's the permanent fund issues, the budget for Fire Marshal State Lands generally. There's a number of legislative issues that on an ad hoc basis the council can look at, but definitely in favor of this one.
Well, if you have others you'd like us to consider, feel free to.
Well, this time we do it ad hoc. So.
All right, any other discussion? Did we vote on that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? Any abstentions? That was not noticed up, and so that's only partially kosher.
We'll have to ratify it.
Well, we have the prior motion, so maybe it's just because we're renewing our motion.
That's how we'll put it in the notes. Thank you, ladies. Any other topics in discussion? How about topics you'd like to have on the agenda for future meetings? Dan?
I'd like to have that study brought next meeting.
Okay.
That's okay.
If Representative Hawks is willing to live to have, I guess it would be a debrief after the session, but
great idea.
A summary of what his good works and others up there on these issues.
Others? Joe and then Dan?
Brian McInerney with NOAA just released his monthly water report, such a snowpack report. He gives a fascinating presentation. I intend to attend with several of them. I think it would be valuable to this council if you're interested in the work he does, that group does, assess snowpack and how that can connect into the G-Slim and how that connects to the lake.
Okay, good suggestion. Others? Dan?
For the next meeting, are we going to meet here? Because we've got to fix the thing. Hold on. As if not, we should go to a different place.
The other two places that we typically met were not available, and the accommodation here is great if that works.
It's good.
We'll make sure we won't come here unless it works. We'll try it out the day before.
Oh, let's wait 2 days before.
No. We'll get their confirmation that it worked. I apologize. That's on me, Dan. Others? Great. Well, thank you, everyone, for being here. Appreciate it, especially council members. So I'll entertain them. please, before we adjourn, please, if you didn't sign in, sign out. We'd like to have a thorough record of everyone who's here. Also, we'll deal with it next meeting. We have a motion to adjourn. Is there a second? Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye. Any opposed, nay.
Don, the assigning sheet's gone. Don's where it is.
Well, I passed it around, but I don't know who has it.
Who's got the signing sheet? Can you find it?
Yeah.
Joe, don't go to the train.